Hello, Joel here. I've got a new book out. It's called Be Funny or Die: How Comedy Works and Why It Matters. And it's about how comedy works and why it matters. Why human beings tell jokes, and then what that tells us about being human beings. So if you're a human being and you enjoy laughing and then want to know what the hell's going on with that, it's probably a pretty good book to read. It's called Be Funny or Die. It's in shops. You can buy it.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need.
Marketing wizards?
Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, I'm Joel Morris. I'm a comedy writer, and I have worked for everyone from Charlie Brooker to Mitchell and Webb to Viz magazine, wrote on the Paddington films, co-created the Ladybird books for grown-ups and the Framley Examiner, loads of stuff like that, which I've been doing for decades. And I love pulling comedy apart. Anyone who's listened to the podcasts I've made, Comfort Blanket or Rule of Three, will know I like analysing, micro-analysing how jokes and stories and comedy ideas work. They say that if you dissect comedy, it's like dissecting a frog. No one laughs and the frog dies. But without dissected frogs, we wouldn't have anatomy or surgery or any of the knowledge about how bodies work. So I think you should kill as many frogs as possible. And the interest of murdering a maximum number of Kermits, I'm writing a book. And the book's called Comedy Basic. It's been published by Unbound. If you search on their website under Comedy Basic by Joel Morris, it's on there. Buy a copy and I will write it. That's the deal. That's how Unbound works. If you go to their website, it's unbound.com/books/comedy-basic, or just search for Unbound and Comedy Basic by Joel Morris. Buy a copy, have a signed one, have some toys, have some free gifts. But the book should be great. It should be really funny, and it'll be a mixture of experience from having done it for a long time and also some anthropology and some neuroscience that'll explain how you can make jokes, how you can make better jokes, how you can have jokes not fail, and what's happening to our brains when we hear comedy, because we are uniquely the only animals that make comedy. Other animals laugh, we're the only ones that make sitcoms. It's a book on that. If you find that interesting, if you've enjoyed any of the podcasts or any of the comedy, you might like it. So look it up and pledge for a copy. It's called Comedy Basic by Joel Morris, published by Unbound. Thank you for listening. This is Comfort Blanket, and I'm Joel Morris. I'm going to be talking to some people who make cool stuff that I like about the warm stuff that they like. The book or the film or the record or the TV show they return to again and again because it'll never let them down. After sort of warm, fuzzy sort of duvet things, but hopefully also that means that they're excellent things. I don't believe you destroy things by analysing them. I think it makes them more fun, and I'm insisting on that quite aggressively. This time I'm talking to the writer and comedian Sarah Kendall. Sarah's a very accomplished stand-up and has appeared on things like Taskmaster, but she's also a really good writer. She won awards for her radio series Australian Trilogy, and she's also written the TV series Frayed, and she has chosen as her comfort blanket the film Muriel's Wedding.
And now let's hear a warm welcome for Act 5 in the Hibiscus Island Star Search. It's Trevor Emma!
Right, you've chosen to bring on the film from 1994, Muriel's Wedding.
Correct, yes, yes.
Is this a very special film for you, or just something that, if it comes on the television, you will always watch?
Both.
Okay.
Yeah, and my initial choice, I mean, I was initially going to go with Seinfeld. That was my first, when we discussed this. And then I was looking for movies to watch with my daughter, and then I thought, I haven't seen Muriel's Wedding for a couple of years. But it's always, it's one of, it's like, for me, it's like Tootsie. It's just one of my kind of go-to classics that
It will never let you down.
Never lets me down. And I was watching it with her, and I just got to the end of it, and I was just like, oh my God. Like, I had just, every time I go back to it, I'm like, it's still perfect. It's, there's nothing There's no fat on the script. It does all the things that I kind of think whenever I'm lost with my writing, it's a piece of work that I go back to. But also it's very much the world that I grew up in.
Penelope! Do that somewhere else, will you? Ask your mum to make a cup of tea.
Mum, make Dad a cup of tea.
So right. For me, on top of all the perfectness of the script and the performances and the comedy, it's like being given a plane ticket into my past. It's exactly my teenage years and where I grew up.
Mum, make Dad a cup of tea.
Me too.
What?
Tea.
So it's speaking for you.
Yeah.
That's the thing with the thing that you love is it's not only is it good and it's crafted and you like it, but sometimes it's just because you go, oh, this is me. It belongs to me.
Yes. Yeah. And my era and my youth and that whole the setting of it and the people. Like I knew guys like Chook and
yeah.
I knew
that's
all
the best name.
Oh, Chook. Chook. I mean, honestly,
Cheryl. Chook, I won't be a minute. Cheryl's upset.
But yeah, and also it's so exciting when you see the kind of hero origin story of these women who've gone on to have these incredible careers.
Yeah.
And you're like, that was when everyone went, wow, who are they? Like,
yeah, it's a breakout film
exactly,
for two big stars.
So exciting. It's a really exciting thing to see people that young kind of giving birth to their career. I think that, you know, that's the joy of it, watching it 20 years down the track.
Well, it's got something in common with, I'm going to compare it now to a film which has got a very different demographic to this. But the first thing it reminded me of watching it, I thought, oh shit, this is With Nan and I.
Right.
This is what boys have an attitude towards With Nan and I, where it's this breakout film for two stars who get to do their great role.
Yes.
It's written, it's got its own internal logic, its own internal world. And the delight of it isn't where the delight is in other films. It's not in even the plot or anything. It's just in, I want to spend time with these amazing people.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, I mean, I'll confess, I'd never seen the film before.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those films, I think, that is destroyed for some section of the audience by its poster.
Oh, what's
which,
the poster?
The poster is the standard rom-com poster.
Oh.
It's a woman in a wedding dress on a white background.
Oh, God.
You know how you do a feel-good film? It's white background.
Yeah,
you cut the people out and you have them being happy.
Runaway Bride.
Slumdog Millionaire. That poster. None of that film is about that. But you go, oh, feel-good rom-com because it's got a white background. And I looked at it and went, oh, that looks quite fun, but I won't bother with it.
It's not my cup of tea.
And you, which is stupid because I love this sort of film. Mm. Within 2 seconds of it coming on, I started laughing.
Yeah, right.
It's Romy and Michelle. It's a really exceptional example of how to do this sort of film to make something welcoming and immersive and totally, it's funny to its bones.
Yes.
It's not got funny lines on top. Yeah. It's just funny.
The best council president this town's ever had. Will you do that for me?
What happened to your nose?
What?
Nothing.
Sunburn, that's all.
And really confident with its funniness. Like, there's
amazing.
So many gags that they don't oversell. Like, the confidence of having a lot of that kind of background comedy, like a sort of tatty kind of like there's a thing happening.
Yeah.
Even the mother making a cup of tea by putting a tea bag in a cup of water and then microwaving it.
Yeah.
And you sort of like just these little details that are happening in the background. So
it's a whole world. And what I felt was when I used the word immersive, it's you're dropped into this world and this class and this place and this time.
Mm.
And every detail of it is thoroughly realized.
Yeah.
The person who's making this film, which is PJ Hogan, the director and writer, knows this world and it belongs to him completely.
I'm a classic oversharer. And Muriel's Wedding was a personal story. You know, I wrote something that I knew a lot about, which was failure.
And these characters belong to him. So it means that the characters in the background are as fascinating to watch as the characters in the foreground. And it's got that busyness, like a cartoon, like an Asterix comic. You're watching all the little characters in the background.
Yeah.
It's busy.
Yeah, I was thinking about just what you're saying now, having seen it God knows how many times. There's a line where Bill Hunter's in the the garden that's been burnt down before the mother suicided.
Spoilers for anyone. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming.
We've seen this. It's fine.
Yeah. FYI, in Tootsie, it's a fella.
What?
It's just this really elegant piece of writing where he says, you know, I guess you reap what you sow. Like it's a really, you know, it's quite trite. But then he goes, you think I would have figured that growing up on the land? And in that, like in that line, you're like, yeah, of course that guy, that age, that year, of course he grew up on the land. And for him to say a reap what you sow kind of thing is a little bit corny. But then when he comes in with, you think I would have known that growing up on the land. And you're like, yeah, there's just these really it takes its time, but it's really, there's no fat on it.
It's lean and fast.
Oh, God, yeah.
I'm Constable Saunders, and this is Constable Gillespie.
Saunders? You're not Graham Saunders' oldest boy, are you?
Brad.
Young Brad. I haven't seen you since you played fullback for the Pauper Spit Giants. How's your dad? How's he recovering from that stroke?
He's better than he was.
You're terrible, Muriel.
How about a beer? Cold one before you go to work. Betty?
Yes? What?
Get the young fellas a beer.
Oh. I was in a meeting yesterday. I was sort of talking about how you write, and really I love the specificity of it, and that's something that I love, and some people really don't like it, you know, like I think that it's become a real sort of taste thing, like some people prefer it to be quite nebulous, and but I love mission statements. I love, because if I get married, then I'm not a no one anymore. Like I really love those moments where in 7 words the writer has gone, this is what this is. You know, like it's not inference.
You're holding the audience's hand and you're saying, watch this woman. Mm. She said what she wants. Now watch and see if she gets it or doesn't get it. So you, as an audience member, I think this is why it's important. Yeah. You as an audience member then get to join in the fun.
Yes.
Because you know she stated what she wants. It's really clear.
And if someone wants to marry me, I'm not her anymore. I'm me.
Her.
Muriel! Muriel Heslop! Stupid, fat and useless. I hate her. I'm not going back to being her again.
Yeah.
Not in a cheesy way, not in a clumsy way, but it's been said out loud. This is what she wants. Now watch her get it or not get it, and then delight in her getting it or delight in her not getting it. She doesn't deserve it.
Yeah.
You're inviting the audience to join in.
Yes.
And if you veil or you use too much subtext, sometimes the audience is too busy running to keep up.
I agree. And all my favourite comedies and all my favorite films, you know, Tootsie, you know, there is this mission statement. I'm going to get a job. But I, as a writer, and you know, being a writer, it just, there are so many moments of just complete despair and depression, but those lifelines that you have in the script are, what does my character want? And they are going to die if they don't get it. Like, because we were talking, like when we were sort of talking about what this chat, you know, we had a brief phone chat, and What I don't like about myself is that if I had seen the one page précis of this as a pitch, I would have gone, this is just a bit mad, and there's too many deus ex machinas in here. Like, I don't
stuff just happens.
Yeah, exactly.
For a film that's got enormous clarity and enormous audience openness, you're very welcome to come in and join in immediately. You know what's going on. You can read the characters. The performances really help it, but the dialogue, the setups, the character work just sells you. You're welcome into it. For a film that's like that, at the same time, it's full of these absolute blindsides.
It's so...
Things happen for no reason at all, like they do in real life.
Yes.
In a quite nice way. But suddenly someone will be struck down and suddenly be ill. And you go, but they never set up that she's going to be ill. And I went, no, because actually, I don't know what it is. The characters are strong enough, or I'm invested by this point enough to not go, hey, you didn't warn me that was going to happen.
Yeah.
And instead of being angry about the surprises, you're delighted by the surprises.
Yeah.
And I'm with you. I don't know how it pulls it off apart from just confidence.
I can't move my legs.
The bad version of that, it'd be a movie that I'd switch off, because I'd go, there are too many story events and the story events feel too big. Like this person's got a cancer on their spine, and in a couple of scenes later, the other character is going to marry a South African swimmer who wants to swim at the Olympics, but because of apartheid hasn't been allowed to. Like, you'd sort of go, this is, like, if I was in a script meeting, I'd go, I think it just, it's...
Bring it down, make it smaller, make
it's soap opera. It's crazy.
Certainly for a Brit who watches this, is it does have a relationship to daytime soap opera.
Yeah.
It feels to be written knowingly in the language of what we import over here, which is Australian daytime soap opera.
Right.
Domestic drama at a slightly heightened level. But weirdly, without it being a parody or a pastiche, it doesn't feel like French and Saunders doing Neighbours or something.
No.
The thing I think that sells this is that everything in it is broad and big and brash and vulgar and bright.
Mm.
But oddly, instead of that being unrealistic, it's incredibly realistic.
Yes.
And I think that what it's got, and I'll put this on a pedestal, an example of why this needs to be known.
Mm.
Comedy, because it's bigger and sillier and broader, is more realistic than drama. Because the size of these characters and the randomness of the events and the energy of it feels like life.
Yes.
In a way that a minutely observed art house thing where no one is reacting
makes me after a while go, oh, fuck it, people aren't like this.
People are
stupid. They make dumb mistakes. Yeah. They're bigger. They make each other laugh. They have huge expressive faces. And I, about 10 minutes into this, I thought, this has just got the energy of real life.
Yes.
Even though none of it is realistic.
Yeah.
Its courage to be bigger than life makes it feel more authentic.
We always knew Mariel had come good.
She's in all the papers.
What happened to you?
I had cancer.
It's all right. I cut it out. I won't walk again, though.
You were so full of life.
I'm not dead, Cheryl.
All of these characters have got integrity. Like, whenever they get to speak their piece, they do say a thing that makes you go, got it.
Yeah.
So, you know, when Rhonda says, I'm never going back to Pauper Spit, no matter what happens, you cannot send me back to Pauper Spit.
Promise me something. We never go back there.
You kind of get, so she is this big, brash character, but then when she says a thing like that, you're like, okay, I got it. You were a loser back in Pauper Spit, and now you've got this fabulous life in the city. I empathize with you. I've connected with you emotionally, so it doesn't feel silly. It doesn't feel big.
Promise we never go back.
I promise.
With Muriel, you know, when she's saying, Dad, we're not losers. You know, you're always telling us that we're losing. We're not like, they do have these moments of really pure drama and empathy.
Yes.
You go, I will go with you on the bigger journeys because I feel connected to you as a human.
That old thing, right, what you know. So I knew that I came from, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10 of crazy, I came from a family that was an 8. So I wrote about them.
There's a desperation about these characters.
Oh, yes.
And I think desperation sells well in scripts because I think most adults understand desperation.
The way they picked on me, Pauper Spit, saying I wouldn't amount to anything, and here I am, famous, and they're at my wedding. I showed them.
Showed them what?
I'm as good as they are.
Whenever you're doing a script, you should say, well, what do these characters want?
Yes.
Well, okay, let's turn that up to 10. What are these characters desperately
exactly.
want?
Exactly. And if you don't get it.
Where are you going?
Where do you think? Back to Pauper Spit with Mum. We're catching the bus out tonight.
So oblivion. What's at stake? Right.
And all of them, it feels like there's oblivion at stake.
I don't want you to.
Well, you should have thought of that before you gave up on me. I couldn't pay all the rent without you. I couldn't even do the shopping. I needed help. I needed a friend.
I mean, I don't want you to go back by bus. I bought you 2 plane tickets.
Go to hell.
No matter what the surface nonsense of this is, the fluff and the ABBA costumes and the bigger than life jokes and things like that, whenever one of them states what they want, it's authentic and convincing and you can relate to it.
Yeah.
None of them says, I've got to win a jam festival. They go, Dad, we're real people, or I want to be happy.
No.
They are big, vital ambitions.
Yes.
So every time it sort of goes back to the core of what the characters want, number one, they desperately want it.
Yeah.
And number two, it's a thing you can completely understand.
Yes.
The armatures, the skeletons of all these characters are thoroughly convincing.
I'm going to be a success, Mum. I'm going to get married and I'm going to be a success.
I know you are. Your dad just wants to be proud of you, that's all.
I'll show him. I'll show them all.
We're finally start writing, we wrote a spoof crime thing called A Touch of Cloth.
Mm.
And it took us a while to work it. yeah, exactly. For TV. And it was a spoof police thing. And the joke with it was always, we realised after a while that it had to be real murders.
Yeah.
That if the detective wasn't investigating a real murder, then weirdly, even though it was just police squad.
How much did I enjoy Touch of Cloth?
Well, there,
how much did I enjoy that?
But it was the motive for it all the time was that there was a real criminal who was really going to kill you.
Otherwise, you tuned out.
And that was that wasn't even Muriel's Wedding realistic. That was a massive, stupid cartoon.
Yeah.
But it's interesting how much underneath, no matter how silly your thing is, no matter how silly your sitcom is or your film or your comedy idea is, if the people at the bottom fundamentally underneath the surface really, really want something, and it's something real and really important, then the motor just works.
Also, I feel like there has to be skin in the game. Like there has to be, and I was just thinking as you're saying that, how there has to be something at stake. Like even in Tootsie, which is again, high stupid, like really, I mean, man dresses as a woman to get a part in a soap opera, you know, but you know, there are those moments in the script where like, you know, Jessica Lange is like, you have to go and see my father tonight. You are going to break him if you, if you, this is, he's a widow.
Real emotions are at stake.
Exactly. Exactly. So it's not, you have to go and my dad's going to propose to you. And oh my God, it's going to be so like, go. Like, it is this kind of, please don't devastate him. It's my dad.
You're talking here. When you said about there are plot elements that don't make sense, you're given the one page thing and you go, actually, you need to work that a bit harder. Let's have it set up a bit better that she might get ill. Let maybe see foreshadow.
Yes.
Or whatever. Maybe see her attitude to someone else who got ill. Maybe there was a kid at school who was in a wheelchair and she's mean to her. And then she learns what it's like to be in a wheelchair. None of that's in there. Mm. What you're talking about there is plot. And plot elements and plot beats. And very often when you're a writer, you get all the plot beats right. And you go, well, this will be great because all the plot beats make sense. But what you sometimes forget to do is to drill down and say, what about the emotional through line? And with this film, which is a big, silly comedy that's meant to just make you laugh, the emotional through line is absolutely clear.
Yeah.
And so no matter how silly it gets, no matter how many coincidences they string together, you follow them because the emotional line is so carefully drawn.
Yes. And so elegant. Every single character in like the best sitcom way has got an arc.
Yeah.
Everybody goes on a journey. The way we're just watching it with my daughter and when the mother turns up at the wedding at the back of the place and she'd got a bus there.
Where the husband has pushed her away and gone off for a really seedy affair.
She's
the backbone of the family and she's completely underappreciated.
Yeah.
And Muriel is seeing more and more in her the future that will lie ahead of her if she lets these men dominate her.
Yes.
That is subtle writing. It's really good.
But
she turns up at the wedding.
Yeah, and she's at the back of the church and then Muriel walks past her and doesn't even see her.
Yeah.
Her reaction shot to her daughter not seeing her and having turned up, having caught the bus, a 6-hour bus journey. Yeah. Sweaty, tired, dressed up with the presents. I mean, I genuinely burst into tears just seeing that reaction shot on a minor character in a high camp, over the top. Like, to feel that connected and that, and again, it's the integrity of it. It's not the mum turns up late and then Muriel doesn't see her. It is, no, let's sit in how that's going to feel for that person and let it breathe and get a good reaction shot and get a great actress to do it. You feel everybody is having to exist in each emotional beat. You're not just skipping over it to the next thing. There are consequences for their behaviour. Yeah.
You owe us, Dad. We're not useless. We never were. Now you're looking after the kids and you're going to tell them they're not useless.
The plot beats don't just tick by. You can see on everyone's faces the effect they've had.
Yeah.
And even though you're right, you said this is a very interesting film in that it is camp. It is larger than life.
Mm.
But there's a sincerity to it and it's got something in common with it. It's got lots of music in it.
Mm.
You know that stupid thing people say when they say, oh, I don't like musicals because people wouldn't burst into song in real life. That doesn't really happen, so I can't invest in it. And you go, what if the emotion they were expressing was bigger because they were doing something improbable or impossible? Mm. And that's core to the idea of camp, that something is simultaneously very, very clearly not happening.
Yeah.
It's Batman. It's not real.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the emotions of it are real.
But just to sort of drill into that a bit more, there is an accepted suspension of disbelief when you buy a ticket to a film.
It's
like when
really
I saw
happening.
Dallas Buyers Club, I know Matthew McConaughey didn't die of AIDS. Like, what is this authenticity they're talking about?
Where's the limit of it? And I think this relates to something which I remember loving, and I quote this all the time, but Ken Campbell said that all drama that doesn't have jokes in it should have its funding removed because the point of drama is to reflect life and life is funny.
Yeah.
And I thought of that all the way through this. I'll describe the experience of watching this. So I bunged it on. I thought, I hope this is good.
Yeah.
And within minutes, I had a rolling giggle in my stomach that wouldn't stop. And I thought, oh, I think I love this.
Yeah, right.
And I was trying to work out what had sold me on it.
Mm.
And it was, a lot of this is sold off Toni Collette's face.
Yeah.
It goes in close on her. And what she does is she reacts to everything.
Mm.
And it's in her face. And sometimes she reacts by looking hurt because it's about a girl who's been rejected and is deemed unacceptable.
Yeah.
So all that hurts in her face.
Yeah.
And then when she's happy, her face explodes.
Yeah.
And I'm going, oh my God, I'm taking cues from the screen about how to feel. And a lot of the time I'm just feeling delight.
Yeah.
And I think it's because I can see you're enjoying yourself.
You know, know, that sort of put your character up a tree and throw rocks at them. You couldn't really have done more in the opening 20 minutes in terms of throwing rocks at her. It's horrific.
Explain what happens in the opening setup scene. Again, as a setup, you go, "Ah, you've got me now."
Yeah, right. So she's at a wedding. She looks dreadful. She's like in a mix of leopard prints at a wedding that she sort of hasn't been invited to, and she catches the bouquet.
Looks like I'm next.
And they're like, "Not God, Muriel caught it." And then they tell Muriel to give the bouquet to the more popular girl, so she has to hand it over.
Muriel, throw it again.
Then the police arrive.
Miss, we'd like to have a word to you about your dress.
What's wrong with it?
You stole it.
So she shoplifted the outfit.
There's a store detective at the wedding who tried to follow her out of the shop when she stole the dress, lost her, and then turned up at the wedding and went, there she is.
Yeah, I mean, already you're like, what, where are we?
I'm so pleased. I had the perfect arrest record until I lost her and boys wear.
How did she be here?
I didn't. I'm the groom's cousin.
So then she doesn't get invited on a holiday. And then they go, "Look, you're not coming on this." She's like, "What holiday?" And they're like, "Oh, we weren't going to tell you, but
we don't want you hanging around us anymore.
We don't want you to come on the holiday. You're not like us. Like, we like to have fun and we listen to great bands and you listen to ABBA.
We've told you 1,000 times how to do your hair, but you never listen. You never wear the right clothes. You're fat. You listen to 70s music. This is the 90s.
Then she wrangles money out of her father's lover by pretending that she gets a blank check from the mother.
Blank check. Cash.
She does a series of bad things.
Yeah, terrible things.
You're terrible, Muriel.
Basically exploiting her mother's mental illness to get a blank check to go to Hibiscus Island, where she bumps into a girl from her school.
Are you Muriel Heslop? No.
Who is now quite glamorous but was a loser at school.
Rhonda Eppenstall. We're at high school together. You dropped out in year 10. I dropped out in year 11.
The nasty girls see her in Hibiscus Island at the resort and they're like, "What the fuck are you doing here?
You mental case! You keep away from us!"
And then the first moment of triumph is the talent night where these two girls who were losers in high school do Waterloo. They do the ABBA song Waterloo. And you're absolutely right. Toni Collette's face turns from hurt, dismay, lying, conniving, like all the shitty things that she's done. And then it just switches into this growing confidence.
I've never seen karaoke character, which is a trick that people do in comedies a lot. We go, what if they sing a song?
Yeah.
No one will know about them if they sing a song. And you go, oh, God, it's the laziest way of doing it.
Yeah.
I've never seen it done better than this. It happens about 20 minutes in, so it's nice and early. So you're ready to go, oh, can I feel up? Can I have some upbeat thing? They do the big ABBA number here in Romy and Michelle, where they do Time After Time at the end, and it's the triumphant moment.
Yeah.
You have to wait ages for that.
Yeah.
This, they go, right, what the audience wants, what will delight them is, you've seen this girl get trodden on and trodden on and trodden on.
Yeah, and she really wants to go to Hibiscus Island, and she shouldn't have got the blank check out of her mother. That was bad, but okay.
Oh, but she's been treated so badly, I feel. I mean, the beginning is basically Matilda. It's a Roald Dahl level of mean things happen to a nice person. So eventually you go, oh, it's really unfair. We all have felt we're that person.
Mm.
Everyone, I remember feeling at school, I don't know if you felt this at school, if you're ever in a gang, I always thought I was the fifth member of the five-member gang.
Right.
That they would let me go at any moment.
Okay.
I never thought I was member one.
You were the Joey Bishop of the Rat Pack.
Yeah, you're always, everyone feels like the Joey Bishop. And Muriel is the ultimate Joey Bishop of her gang. And it's got that lovely Heather's Mean Girls setup where they're the mean girls and they are stick thin Gold Coast beach bunnies. And she is the outsider. She's a bit zaftig and so she doesn't fit in. And they get rid of her, they ditch her, and immediately they ditch her, you go, I'm on your side. I hope something nice happens to you.
Mm.
And because it's a film that's concerned with delighting its audience, 20 minutes in, she's dressed as Agnetha in the most enormous silver catsuit, and she gets to sing her triumphant song.
Yeah.
20 minutes in, you get to see her, and you go, oh God, I'm in love now, because this is just going to, every time I want her to do well, the film will go, don't worry, we won't make you wait.
It's
brilliant.
It is. It's beautiful. And just seeing their performance, because, you know, Rachel Griffiths is the sort of, Rachel Griffiths plays the other girl from
Rhonda.
High school, Rhonda. And she's the, you know, she's confident from the get-go, but you see Toni Collette during the song growing in confidence and you can hear the audience enjoying it more and more and more. The audience is really getting into it at the talent quest. And then by the time they get to the chorus and they've got the dance moves together and They also film it a bit like an ABBA music video as well. They have that kind of,
it's the Lassie Hallström thing where they're side on and face
That's
on.
That's right.
And also, I love the link to Australia's absolute love affair with ABBA, that ABBA the movies all set in Australia.
That's right.
It goes, this feels completely organic and natural. Yeah. And there's something just wonderful about it. And then he intercuts it with a massive fight.
And can I say, so that's Pippa, the woman who plays that character, who she's also in the show that I did, Frayed.
Oh.
And the first time I met her, I was like, I just have to get this out of the way, that Muriel's Wedding just, I just felt, when it came out, I just felt like it was talking to girls like me. It was just a comedy for me. I felt like it was mine, you know.
Wow.
And we talked so much about it. And then I said to her, I really want to write a catfight scene between you and I, because I just loved the catfight in Muriel so much. So I got to have a catfight with her. In Frayed, and I feel like I was just living out my cinematic fantasies. Like, the next thing I have to do is write a scene with Dustin Hoffman where he's putting on a face of makeup or something. But it was just really, she was a real joy to work with, and really happy to talk about Muriel's Wedding. You know, it was just really nice, real fan moment.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
If I couldn't type, why did they give me my secretarial diploma?
Because I paid for it. Sits around the house like a dead weight. Watching TV, sleeping all day, getting arrested at weddings. You're useless.
I was also thinking about this, just in, like, off the back of what you're saying there, but also in terms of how big it is.
Yeah.
And it's a really bold declaration that you are on a hero's journey. And I was thinking about how she is an Indiana Jones or a Luke Skywalker. You get the feeling of an almost Shakespearean level quest of your hero.
And she started off on the backwoods. She's on Tatooine. She's looking at the twin sons are a wedding.
Yes.
She's staring off. You know what she wants. She says what she wants. What the quest is.
Yes.
We get married. And then it plays jokes on every one of those things.
Yes, yes, yes.
Because the wedding's fucking shit when she gets it.
Yeah, oh, completely. She gets it. She doesn't get it. And I just kind of think that there is tonally, I mean, it's Muriel's Wedding. We know it is about this central character, but there is a sort of like that kind of King Lear level of, this is a big journey for a big character.
I know I'm not normal, but I'm trying to change. I'm trying to become more like you, more of a...
It's too late.
I can change.
You'll still be you.
There are those sort of Australian comedies that are a bit more, I don't know, this just feels like a real hero's journey.
Oh, by the way, I'm not alone. I'm with Muriel.
And it has the scope of a hero's journey. She covers huge amounts of territory.
Yeah.
Muriel's out there and she's made something of herself.
And she was the most useless one of all, wasn't she, Bill?
You're buying into a huge journey with this character, and it knows, it's done with a confidence. It handles all of its jokes so well.
Do you ever dream about what you would say to them if you saw them now?
I do see them now. They're over there.
What are they doing here?
Well, they're on Tanya's honeymoon. Chook couldn't come.
I can't think, like, there are no jokes in that where I kind of go, oh, that didn't really land, or
Stick your drink up your ass, Tanya. I would rather swallow razor blades than drink with you.
It has a confidence in a language. It's a type of film, and there are, I wish there was a word for these type of films, a film where the world itself is what you're enjoying.
Mm.
There's a confidence in the world building of it.
Mm.
And I'm going to lump some together because I like these kind of films, and I'm going to say it's Bill and Ted.
Excellent!
And it's With Nail.
Cake and fine wine. Yeah.
And it's Romy and Michelle.
I think you are like the funnest person I know.
Me too! You.
What you do is you come up with a language and a tone and a sort of joke. Taika Waititi's films.
Yeah.
No, those foundations are gone. Sorry.
A type of humour that is completely in a sealed bubble.
Yes.
And just says, look, I find this funny. Yeah. These are my rules. Yeah. And this is the way they talk. And tomorrow in the playground, you'll be able to do impressions of people. You'll be able to go, you're terrible, Muriel.
Yeah.
There'll be catchphrases. There are easily impersonable voices. Everything's big. So we're saying to you, here is your cartoon world.
Yeah.
And you will, when you try and write your first script, you're a fan of this, it'll be a copy of this.
Yeah.
Because the voice is confident. And there's a joy in that that's nothing to do with structure or skill or joke telling. It's just saying, here is the language I use to express my view of the world.
Yeah.
I give it to you, fully formed. Within seconds, you can impersonate it.
Yes.
It is a comic voice you will be able to do.
God, that's so true.
And you will possibly steal this.
Yeah.
And maybe it'll be the stabilisers on your writing bike that you'll ride on for a while. And you'll actually be able to take them off and fly away. It just says, I have total confidence in this world I've invented.
Yeah.
And I felt that within minutes of watching this. I went, oh, you've got this.
Muriel, how was that wedding?
She was arrested.
That's lovely. And you wish you were 22 again, Betty? Remember that age.
There's another aspect of this that revels in the cultural cringe and then proudly doesn't cringe.
Yes.
Which I think is a really, as an Australian and sort of coming out of, like, that was sort of during that period where Australia just kept producing these really camp comedy classics.
Yeah.
So there's Priscilla, there's Strictly Ballroom. I would put Muriel's Wedding in with this. I mean, those were the three big hitters of that era.
Yeah, it's a huge wallop. And it came out of nowhere. And it's this post-Crocodile Dundee.
Right, exactly. And it was kind of going, okay, take your cultural cringe and shove it up your asshole.
Yes.
Because this is who we are. And it's, and yeah, we're not like the rest of the world. And no, we don't speak like Americans. We don't speak like British people, but we're not shit. You know, like we've got our own, and we have great art and great creativity. And it was really pushing back on this idea. It's taking pride in who we are and not being ashamed of it.
Yeah.
And
it's holding it up and saying, this looks funny. This this looks funny to outsiders. The, the language. This is all set in what's called Bogan sort of culture. Loosely,
right, exactly,
isn't it?
Exactly.
Which is, if people don't know what that is, that's, that's, you can explain
it
to me.
Well, it is, it's that kind of really working class, you know, although, I mean, the dad in this, you know, he did have aspirations to be a member of parliament and stuff, but
there's something fascinating in this, certainly as a Brit watching it, again, the ostensible classlessness of Australian society. And here you go, this is so class-ridden.
Yes.
The idea of looking down on that working class culture. But weirdly, in a British version of this, it was like a Mike Lee film about working class people, one of them wouldn't be trying to get into parliament. The madness of going, it's so classless. The children are all unemployed, but he's going to be a major, like, corrupt politician. Its flavour is very specifically Australian. And it feels like those films, those very camp, feminised or noisily bright and brash films that came out, were a deliberate attempt to try and reinvent Australia after Crocodile Dundee, which had just said macho.
Exactly, exactly.
Mad Max and Crocodile Dundee say macho desert culture.
Yes,
and
exactly.
This says suburban, female,
feminized, gay
camp. And it's PJ Hogan said he was trying to make the anti-Crocodile Dundee.
Yeah.
And he's speaking through the voice of these women and speaking authentically and very sympathetically and empathetically through them.
Yeah, and interestingly, at the end of this movie, you know, the ending of the film is the love between these two women.
Yes.
And I'm not saying it's sapphic love, but the ending is the strength of love.
100%.
Yeah. So
it's Spice Girls.
Yes. There's no space for men in the ending. It is not, there is the, for something that is called Muriel's Wedding, it is an absolutely male-free, completely passes the Bechdel test. Bechdel?
It's Bechdel up the wazoo, this film.
I never know how to pronounce the word, which is interesting.
Women should gather and discuss
Bechdel?
Amongst themselves how to say Bechdel.
I said Bechdel. I will
Bechamel.
Say Bechdel.
The Bechamel
the
test.
The Zooey Bechamel test. But it totally passes the test because it does end on an absolutely male-free moment, impulse, ending their future together.
They are friends.
Yes, and they choose each other.
Bye, straight. Anybody could be that guy. Bye,
And you said it's a hero's journey. She's Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
He doesn't get the arc and he doesn't want the arc. He wants the girl.
Yeah.
He wants the friend.
Yeah.
And the end of this is you didn't get the wedding was the MacGuffin, the thing you thought you wanted. Your quest was there.
Yes.
You wanted that, but you needed this.
Yeah.
And that's a classic hero's journey.
Oh, God. As such, I mean, when you say it, it's just you wanted that, but you needed that. And as a technician, you're just like 10 out of 10. I mean, on technical points, I just can't fault it. It just doesn't, there's never a misstep. And I'm always, I get that kind of roller coaster ride feeling of there's so much happening and I can't wait for what's going to happen next.
That's why you can watch it again. With a film like this that you said quite often, it's chaotic.
Yeah.
It's having too much fun to care about structure and technical stuff. And then the moment you start picking it apart, you go, oh no, it's got everything right.
And again, and this is like the thing that makes me kind of go, God, I just don't trust myself, is that, so the whole beat in the story where Muriel goes, right, I'm going to get married, I'm going to look around, and then she's circled, you know, that she can meet this person, and it's the South African Olympic swimmer.
I've worked out all the details of the romance, which you and David will have to stick to. But the most important thing is to convince people that you two are really in love.
What about the blonde?
You didn't like her.
I'm not so sure now.
Now, if that was pitched to me in a meeting, I would say, you've introduced this South African swimmer how many minutes in?
Quite 70 minutes in. The guy she definitely wants.
The guy that she wants. The thing that she now wants is we're quite a fair way into this movie. Why am I going to give a shit about what happens with him rejecting her or when he turns up at the funeral?
Shouldn't we have seen some stuff about the Olympics in the beginning, Act
right.
One?
Should he have been someone she already knew or...
I mean, look at Rachel Griffiths' character. Look at Rhonda. Rhonda turns up when she goes away on holiday.
Yes.
And she's a girl she knew from school. But you go, shouldn't we have seen that they knew each other at school at the beginning? It runs itself a little bit like a sitcom, like there are different episodes.
Yes.
What you've got is a bunch of almost like unrelated sketches with new characters turning up like episodes in a story. And you go, but hang on, this is a film. It's supposed to have a unity and a unified thing. And then you go, I don't care.
Yeah. This just feels like a perfect example of, you know, as with life in art, you can do anything if you're funny. And those scenes that kind of, as a technician, like you sort of 6 hours later, you go, hang on, why did they get away with that? Because they were funny. So the whole scene.
The energy carries you through.
And the swimming, that scene at the swimming pool. So if you haven't seen the movie, she basically answers an ad about a fast marriage and she turns up at an Olympic swimming pool and there's this stunning blonde South African swimmer.
David Van Arkel, Mariel Hislop.
The only way he can compete at the Olympics, because of apartheid, the South Africans have been banned. So he needs an Australian marriage so that he can compete at the Olympics. Now, Muriel meets this guy and she lights up a cigarette inside the Olympic swimming pool training area, which is already, and she looks, all her makeup's too loud. And then they said, you know, the coach says something along the lines of,
Muriel, you've probably seen the news about the civil war in South Africa. Well, just as the South Africans seem to be doing the right thing by the blacks, the police open fire on a black soccer club, and that is bad news.
And then she takes a drag on the cigarette and goes, oh, my God, are you black? to the And then she goes, oh, sorry, because she's so dazzled by how handsome he is. Yeah. She pulls this weird face at him, like she kind of goes a bit cross-eyed, like, bleh. But it's so huge. But again, they just get away with it because they have a fantastic comic offer for the scene. And you are so with this hero. You're so on her side and so sold by her impulse, and we've already set up she wants to get married, so this kind of does fit in. But the thing that surprises me is that when he turns up at the mother's funeral, I care about them. And I'm like, I've known this character for about 15 minutes of a 80-minute film so far.
It's a testament to the economy of the character writing and also the fact that they make it really clear what they want.
Yeah.
So you can hold in your head a vast cast of like Dickensian grotesques and know what they want so that when they turn up, you go, oh, good, him.
Yeah.
I know what he wants. He's the apartheid swimmer.
Yeah.
And so you as an audience member feel very, very safe with it.
Yeah.
I can't stay married to you, David. I've got to stop lying now. I tell so many lies. One day I won't know I'm doing it. I don't love you.
I don't love you either, but I don't know. I think I could like having you around.
You mentioned this is a hero's journey, and I'm now thinking about this. No one ever talks about comedies in this sense. that they are very often exactly structurally the same as an action movie or any other story you want to tell. Everything is the same story. Mm. And there's a thing that Spielberg said about Indiana Jones. He said, I have to get the audience at the beginning of Raiders of the Lost Ark to accept this improbable adventure story in the opening 90 seconds. And if they buy that, I've got them for the rest of the film.
Right.
And I think Muriel's Wedding works the same way. It's that opening scene at the wedding where she's thrown the bouquet and they go, not you. The whole point about the randomness of throwing the bouquet.
Muriel caught it.
Yeah, so you go, oh, you're unacceptable. I follow this. Oh, I like you. You're an outsider.
Yeah.
And then within seconds you go, well, what sort of outsider is she? She's the sort of person who stole the wedding dress, turned up at a wedding she wasn't supposed to be at, and the store detective's there, and it's like the worst day of her life. She's just bundled into a police car and taken out of the wedding.
Yeah.
By that point, you've got me on board to, this is the language of this film.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
If I buy that, the store detective would dob you in at the wedding you've turned up in the dress, and I go, yeah, cause that's a really funny idea.
Yeah.
I'd like you to keep making me laugh, please.
Yes.
So
yes,
what
yes.
I will not do is put my hand up at any point the rest of the film. So by the end of it, they can introduce the South African swimming champion.
Yeah.
And I don't put my hand up because I said at the beginning I was going to get on the ride.
That's so true.
Because it's been painted with such broad brushstrokes, you'd think it'd be clumsy. Mm. But obviously what it is, they've just put a bigger canvas.
Yeah.
So instead of, you can do a miniature and make it really precise. That's realistic and affecting. But this is a huge mural.
Yeah.
It's a mural. Yeah, and they've got the big house painting brushes. They're doing it massive.
Yeah, yeah.
But because of that, it's got enormous clarity.
Yes.
So you can follow all the emotional things. And oddly, the precision that gives it, and you think that broadness and camp aren't precise, but this is very precise.
Mm.
You can read it, and that means the emotional stakes are really fucking clear.
Mm. I was just thinking, there's probably a version of Muriel's Wedding that is a Napoleon Dynamite version of Muriel's Wedding.
There's a version of this that is ironic and detached.
Yes, yes. It's very knowing.
This is sincere.
It is. Yeah, it does. That's
it's
exactly.
It's not cynical.
No, it's not. It is actually a very open-hearted. It is taking itself seriously.
Like, yeah. These are real people.
Yes. And
that's a really good point.
Yeah. And as we said, At the outset, there is a kind of, if I don't, my life depends on this. If I don't get this, this is a fight for my soul. This is like the life that I'm going to have.
You know, it was really my last shot at getting a film made because, you know, I was getting close to 30 and I thought, maybe I'm not meant to be doing this. And I'd gone to film school with a lot of people who had established careers. Some were even making a comeback. And here I was, I'd yet to make my breakthrough film. So I sat down and I wrote what I knew.
There is something about setting up those stakes, but doing it in a way that does have integrity. I never felt that I was being manipulated. I know I'm being manipulated.
But beyond the accepted rules of watching any kind of fiction.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. But I felt there was just a humanity. There was an integrity in the script writing and PJ Hogan's choices. And there were so many points in that movie where I honestly, within 30 seconds of laughing really hard, I nearly burst into tears. Yeah.
Mario Van Arkel speaking. Hello?
Muriel?
Mario.
Mum's died.
What?
We're all at the hospital. Dad says you have to come home.
It punches way above its weight emotionally for a comedy. And does that thing that is my you know, it's always the thing that I've tried to work towards in my own work, which is trying to really elegantly pivot out of tragedy into comedy and comedy back into tragedy and just keep that kind of 180 pivot. Except because it's life. It's the only thing that feels real to me.
Yeah.
If I'm going to put it on paper, it has to have some sort of resonance. Otherwise, why am I doing it? But that film just manages to do it scene to scene to scene to scene. You are being emotionally pulled in so many different directions, but in every single, the comedy has integrity and the drama has integrity.
It's never to be underestimated how difficult comedy is. And Jill Bilcock is a marvel at cutting both drama and comedy. If you remember that sequence in Muriel's Wedding where I think it's the beanbag scene where Muriel is, having the worst sex ever filmed, and then everybody's naked, the window's smashed, there are little white balls in the beanbag flying everywhere, and then Rachel Griffiths announces that she can't walk, literally turns on a dime, as the saying goes. Jill Bilcock made all of that work, and she did it by just saying, look, don't, if you're going to go up to the bell, ring it. let's just make this change. Let's pull the rug out from under the audience.
Like nothing is being done in a kind of mawkish or it's not manipulative.
There's nothing cheap about it. And it's a brash, artificial fibres kind of a film.
Yeah.
If you wanted to write a cringe comedy about a bogan family and this outsider girl who doesn't fit in and her naive belief that everything will be sorted when she has the perfect wedding.
God, can you imagine how bad that pitch sounds?
It's terrible.
Yeah.
But what it has to be is written by someone who comes from that family.
Yeah.
It's an insider's view of it. PJ Hogan came from Coolangatta, which is basically renamed...
Coolangatta Gold.
He came from that town and he made it his town.
Yeah.
These are his people. This is his family. I didn't realise Muriel is based on his sister.
Oh, wow.
And he had a dad who was a rotten bully. And he's way worse than the dad is in the film. He's toned him down to make him believable because how he treated my sister was terrible. And his sister was completely cowed by this macho bully in the family and didn't know her own worth and undervalued herself. His sister eventually stole money, joined a cosmetics business and ran away.
Oh,
and
my
he said,
God.
It's all true. He said, so I had this story about my sister. I wanted to tell her story.
Yeah.
And I really felt for her. And you can go, well, there's pain there. The family's got a bully as a dad. He's grown up under that. He's obviously creative, and I imagine it's not much fun having a bully for a dad when you're there. I suddenly feel for him and his sister.
Yeah.
And he starts telling a story, and he went, I didn't have a third act. All I had was my sister ran away.
Right.
So then he said, I had to work and work and work to find a story that could tell that character story. And you go, oh, so you are doing that perfect blend of this happened to me.
Yeah.
It's authentic. It's real. So the emotion's real. And then going, yeah, but I've got to do some craft on top of that.
That's right. It's not enough.
It's what Izzy Sutty once said is you have to put the active ingredient in the yeast of reality will then make your fictional stories grow.
That's so
and
good.
It's got that truth about it. And I think why it doesn't feel cynical, why it doesn't feel cheap is it's not some fucking posh guy writing about how common people are so vulgar.
Yeah. And you know what? It leaps off the screen. The integrity of it, that it is a, you know, if you are pure of heart, then you will be successful in your quest.
Yeah.
You know, I do feel I and you can smell it a mile off. You're like, that all.
But he's speaking for himself as well then, not just Muriel. There's a nice way in which it's odd that it's a man making this film, which is so empathetic to the female characters.
Mm.
There's no sense of it not being his own story as well.
Yeah.
And I think that's really nice.
Yes,
he feels like he's an outsider too.
Yeah, he's Perry.
There's a tendency in comedy to think you're doing something less because it's funny.
Right.
That you're basically, what you should really be doing is aspiring to great drama.
Right.
And certainly in terms of how much you get paid, you do get the feeling that if you're a showrunner or anything that was entirely dramatic, you'd be treated with a lot more respect.
Yeah.
But I think this film is a terrific argument for how many great truths can be told through comedy. And when people talk about their characters, very few people, when they talk about what their family were like, will reach for an allegory in drama, but they will say, oh, we were like the royal family. Mm. Oh, we're like the family in Muriel's wedding. Mm. We're like the family. We're like the Trotters. Oh, my dad was like, people choose sitcom characters because there's an enormous truth in cartoons and caricatures.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think this is a great film. It's a great argument for saying there is huge depth in broad strokes.
Yeah. Yeah. And yet when done badly, I mean, I suppose if you do anything well, it's, you know,
are you saying that when something's done well, it's better?
Yeah, I think that was my point. And then as it came out of my mouth, I thought, you can't get it back in.
You can't bless it was
fucking
mine. You can't let that stuff out. Because if that stuff gets out and people find out about it, it's going to blow some minds.
That's day one of my script writing course. Just try to make it good. I mean, fuck.
People like good shit.
People like good. I'll tell you what they like more than good. They like better. So fucking try that on.
Lunch?
Yeah, and that'll be £800. I was also thinking about how sometimes story events are not plot. With a movie like Muriel's Wedding, there are so many story events, but story events mean nothing without character. Otherwise, you just have a pile of events.
Yeah.
And the bad version of Muriel's Wedding is this is just a bunch of things happening in close succession.
Yeah.
And there is nothing propelling me through this. There are no flags in the sand getting me from event to event. And yet this does manage to put the flags in the sand and lead you to each flag in the sand confidently.
Yeah, the character work is giving you the emotions, and the emotions you're then feeling and reflecting in your heart.
Mm.
And you know why things are happening. You know, Muriel's Wedding does some astonishing things where she meets a new best friend and then abandons that best friend when that friend gets ill, which is a really hard sell.
Yeah.
But at no point did I go, yeah, that's not what Muriel would do, because I knew the character and I knew she was in a selfish space at that point, and I felt for her and I knew why. I knew what her family background was like. There's some astonishing skids and left turns in terms of plot beats that are sold on the fact that you know the characters.
And you know her obsessive drive.
Yeah.
And her obsessive drive will be pursued at the expense of everyone and will be at the expense of her integrity. Like, she has to... Yeah.
She won't find happiness that way, but she's just driven.
Which is the tragic... That is a Macbeth.
Yeah.
So, in a that's what's so impressive about in this comedy. She is, in a way, being an Aristotelian tragic figure in that she has obsessively pursued the thing to her absolute peril and moral downfall.
Yeah, there's a total tragic arc to this.
Mm.
What kind of person marries someone they don't know?
You did.
It's epic and it's big and it's... But you're right, it's all character-led. And I remember working this out. I am still really bad at this. I mean, everyone is. You write your beat sheets out when you're writing, you're plotting things out. And it's a lot of it. You're good at it. And you go, it's not just and. It's so and then and but. I've got all the links. That's all working. Seems to be fine. And then you've forgotten to stand up the character stuff. Or you forgot to interrogate it. And it's just a bunch of cold events.
Yep.
And I remember saying this to someone once. I said, you can always lock a door on a character.
Mm.
They can always be trapped. If you write a ghost story, I'll probably say, oh, God, the door's locked. I can't get out.
Mm.
But it's never as good as the door being open and the character not wanting to go through it.
Oh, that's really good.
And I said, the thing is, you can always mechanically put a door in the way.
Yeah.
But if the door's open, but you as an audience understand that that's the last place the character would ever go, that's writing. And Muriel's Wedding is loads of that writing, where the characters make sometimes wildly improbable decisions.
Mm.
And at no point do you go, she wouldn't do that.
Yeah. And is that, but again, is that just the boldness of the mission statement that each character says,
yes,
here's what I want and here is how I am going to get it?
I think, to be honest, I've done a few of these podcasts now, and the thing that all people's favourite films and shows have got in common is that.
Yeah.
People love it when a character cleverly or very, very blatantly tells you what they want, and you at home are invited to join in.
Yes.
I want to win. All my life I've wanted to win.
Me too.
I also think if, as the writer, if you can't say in one sentence what your character wants, then you are going to be all at sea very quickly.
Yeah.
Because every time you write a new sentence in a new scene, literally anything can happen. You are God. You are the God of this universe. Anything can happen. So how are you going to deal with the 10,000 options that you have at every given moment? So the only thing that you can hold on to is, what does my character want?
Yeah.
And what are they going to do to get it? And I think, especially with comedy, I might not want to die on this hill. but if you're going to, because the comedy moments are a bit, they are tangential, that they are a bit jazz, that you are playing around a bit. If you haven't got the solid foundation of your actual story, you're going to get lost in your comedy moments.
Yeah, that's very true. I always say that one of the things that's really hard with writing comedy is most of the time you can remove jokes.
Yeah.
Because a joke tends to be a side issue to where we're going.
Yeah.
One of the things that's really enjoyable about it is that it flourishes.
Yeah.
And when you're cutting, if you write a script that's 37 pages long for a 30-page slot, you can bet in the edit you will lose all the jokes. And it's one of the reasons where people were, oh, what's that show? There weren't many jokes in it. And you went, yeah, did the plot make sense though?
Right.
And the plot will always make sense because the thing that would have been sacrificed in the edit sometimes is a line.
Yeah.
And I'm always impressed in a show where they've managed to get, say, turns of phrase or character work so that the plot stuff has jokes hanging off it.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, you can always, some slapstick, you can always remove that.
Yeah, yeah.
You can always trim the jokes. And it's one of the things that's really hard to argue for.
Yeah.
Because everyone in when they're doing the edits is saying, well, we need to say this because that's plot.
Yeah.
So you can't cut that.
Yeah.
You can definitely cut all the jokes.
So, are you married now?
What?
Well, you said you weren't Muriel Heslop. If you changed your name, I thought you must have got married.
No. Yes. I'm engaged.
Anyone I know?
What? Who? Tim.
Who?
What?
Tim who? Oh,
Sims.
Tim Sims. Don't know him. What's he like?
Like, no one.
Schmike?
What?
I shouldn't.
You're admiring this film a lot for what it does that you wouldn't do.
Mm.
Is it just useful as a benchmark that you don't know? Because you're a good technical writer and you know the rules for this.
Right.
And your work is technically satisfying.
Right.
So I think we all fall for that, going, I'm going to make this technically perfect. To have something as a favourite film that is technically impressive but doesn't follow those rules.
Yeah.
That occasionally breaks those rules but makes sure it's doing something else.
Yes, yes.
It's quite, I mean, is that what you're getting out of this? Is it, are you in awe? Are you wondering at the chances it's taking, the bravery and the boldness of it?
Yeah, I think so. I absolutely, because I've seen the bad version of that so many times. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. The bad version of that makes me want to put my foot through the telly.
Yeah. The unsaid, the shadow over this film is the bad Muriel's Wedding.
Right.
The one that's got one star.
Yeah.
The one, the endless wedding drama. I mean, the decisions this makes that break it out of rom-com cliche. The fact that she's not looking for a man. The nice man she gets, she leaves behind halfway through. The perfectly nice, good example of like a positive male figure. Just gets completely ignored.
Yeah.
She doesn't get the guy. She gets her friend.
Yeah.
It breaks all the rules of it.
Yeah.
And because it's doing that, you're constantly aware of the dark version of this, the by numbers, on rails, Hollywood, studio script doctored version of it that's got whichever star of the moment was underweight enough to be the star at the front of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything about it. Yeah. There's a shadow of this all the way through of how this might have been.
Do you also have that thing that whenever you get notes back, like network notes, they always say dumb shit like, what if something like this happened? And then you go, because it's just, you're just tacking on a story event. You know, like when someone who draws an enormous salary goes, what if they won lottery? Well, yeah, but I feel like Muriel's Wedding does have moments along the lines of, what if they won lotto? Like it does, it kind of does.
But it's what the guy wanted.
Yeah.
It is auteur madness.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. It is. Yeah.
It judges really well how bawdy to be as well.
Right.
Because it could be like a sort of a fruity, brash, rude sex comedy.
Yeah. Yeah,
and it doesn't. Yeah. It's got immense. I was blown away by what the sex gag is, which is unzipping the beanbag.
Oh, that, yeah.
It's such a good visual bit of slapstick.
Yeah.
But that in a cruder, worse studio version of this film is the spunk in the hair.
Yes,
gag.
Yes.
It's the one where everyone shits themselves in Bridesmaids, where there's a really crude version of that that would play really well and possibly work, but isn't in the tone of this film.
Yeah.
For such a vulgar film, it's incredibly tasteful about so when true. It does shit sex gags.
God, that's so true.
I have to tell you something. I'm a parking inspector.
That's okay.
You're absolutely right. And Rhonda's having a three-way with two American sailors. So the whole scene is that, do you have milk or do you want sugar? And there's this, like happening.
Yeah.
Again, it's just the really strong comedy offer.
Yeah.
That these two very awkward people are going to just, is that milk, two sugars? Would you like a Bicky with your tea? And there's this, you know, sex, really noisy sex. And my daughter was just laughing so much. And I said, you know what's really fun about this is that those actors would have had to go into the ADR booth and done about 3 minutes of sex noises at the microphone. And then the sound mixer would have put that all in together. They're not in the next room. That's just an ADR thing.
Biggies?
What? Sure.
Is this a similar kind of, you know, there is that, you know, with the fairy tale genre, you start at a wedding. Like, this is very much The Godfather. This is The Deer Hunter.
Yeah.
We start at a wedding and everything's wonderful. And then there's the store detective. And, you know, and in the Deer Hunter, there's the Vietnam veteran going, you boys shipping out tomorrow. Well, fucking good luck. You know, there's the harbinger of doom at the wedding. Is that sort of what he's stylistically doing? That this is a world where you're not safe.
Yeah.
There is a creeping malevolence at all times.
Yeah, because her dad is the essence of evil within the house. And it's like, it's a banal kind of evil. He's just mean to his wife and he's basically corrupt and racist and things.
Yeah.
There's that figure in there, which is just, she's in a position where she's not safe, where she's got home. Her home isn't safe. She needs to get out of her home.
Yeah.
So basically a marriage would be the perfect way to do it. And at the end, it turns out that actually what she needed was a friend.
Yeah.
She thought she wanted, the only way to buy her way out of being a reject at home, this dumb, awful thing with this bullying dad would be to get married. And it turns out what she needs is a good female friend, someone who respects her and likes her.
Yeah.
So she's in danger and the only way to save her Prince Charming is a best friend.
Yeah.
It's a really good subversive story.
Yeah.
There.
Now, if you put this under your pillow, you'll dream of your future husband.
There's a horrible story PJ Hogan tells about his real dad, who obviously sounds like an awful person. And he describes him as being Trumpian.
Right.
Like sort of having that thing where he just denies reality.
Yeah.
And he had no respect for his kid, for him being creative. Or I get the feeling that PJ Hogan is slightly Muriel as well. That he's the one who doesn't fit in. He can't work out what to do with him.
Yeah.
And he said when the film was a success, his dad saw it and loved it.
Oh, he didn't.
He didn't see himself in it. Pure Trump.
Couldn't
see himself.
Oh, narcissism.
And also,
yeah.
And also just said, the film's a success. My child's a success.
Oh, God.
And he liked the success so much.
It didn't matter.
He couldn't see
that
it was about the evil cancer at the heart of that family.
Oh.
And I think that's why, again, why it's a good film. I think it's got an honest heart. It's a scream. It's a film about choosing.
Mm.
And she's at that stage, which we've all been at, where you're in a family and you didn't choose your family.
Mm.
Your family are imposed upon you and you grow naturally out of it.
Mm.
And at some point you have to choose to leave. And that's what she's trying to do. So I'm going to find the perfect guy, going to get married. I'm going to choose to leave.
Mm. Goodbye, pauper spin.
Yeah. And what she's forgetting is that you can also choose friends.
Yes, yes.
And the message of the film is really simple. It says, look, if you want to get out of your family, you want to escape, you can go and get married.
Mm.
Or you could just choose a better family.
Yeah, yeah.
Of mates. We could build your own family. It's such a sweet message.
Oh, that final scene where they're driving out in the taxi and it's Rachel Griffiths and Toni Collette saying, goodbye, beach. Goodbye, mall.
Goodbye,
oh, God, I was in pieces. I was in absolute pieces.
There's a lovely quote. Rachel Griffiths was interviewed about what the film's about. And she said, when you're fundamentally rejected by your family and your place because who you are is not acceptable within that place, then the families you create beyond that are your lifeboats.
Oh, my God.
And it's about that. It's about escape and realising that the story she's accepted, she's swallowed from fairy stories, is the only lifeboat is Prince Charming, is finding a boy.
Yeah.
And what an amazing message to say, go and find a great mate.
Yeah.
And be mean to them when they get cancer if you want to.
Yeah.
That's allowed.
You know, this idea that marriage is transformative, you literally get a new name.
Yeah.
You know, and if you hate yourself enough,
yeah,
then you will jump at the opportunity
to
take on a new name because then I'm not Muriel anymore. Then I won't be Muriel Heslop.
Well, she changed her name to Mariel, doesn't
Mariel.
She?
I'm Mariel. I'm Mariel Van Binkenberg or whatever the fuck she became.
Van Swimming, yeah.
Yeah. So this idea that marriage is essentially it is transformative, but in a way you lose yourself.
Yeah.
Like it's very critical of marriage. It's going,
yes,
you know,
it's not the answer.
No. And if you want to lose your name, go right ahead. You'll still be you. Like it's just a really.
And then in order to get her friend back at the end where she claims her name back and says, I know I'm Muriel again.
Yeah.
She's found herself again. And the friend said, I accept you for who you are.
Yeah.
It's such a magical world to spend time in.
It is, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah, it made me really homesick. I got really, I mean, bizarrely, because it paints it as like hell. But it did. It made me homesick for the reasons I felt othered there.
Right.
You know, I really recognized that sort of beach culture and the kind of the suburban blandness.
Yeah.
You know, like you do dream of going to Sydney. You do just want to go, you know, and there is that kind of, you know, I love that line where she said, and she says it really seriously when Rhonda's in the wheelchair and she's just had this operation. She says, Rhonda.
When I lived in Pauper Spit, I'd just stay in my room for hours and listen to ABBA songs. Sometimes I'd stay in there all day. But since I've met you and moved to Sydney, I haven't listened to one ABBA song. It's because now my life's as good as an ABBA song. It's as good as Dancing Queen.
Come off it.
My whole world was what I had to paint inside my head when I lived in Pauper Spit. And now that I've left Pauper Spit, I don't have to live in my little internal world in my head there anymore. I can exist and enjoy living because
you've built a shell for yourself, and then you can leave that shell.
Yeah.
And the actual reality of your actual everyday life is as much fun as listening to ABBA. Yeah, I thought it was a magical line that.
But
it's the whole theme of the film.
But also doing that with the band ABBA. I mean, what an amazing thing to do as a writer, to have this really resonant piece of dialogue. You know, since I've got to Sydney, I haven't listened to ABBA once. And for that to be like this, holy shit.
But you buy that.
Yes.
It's telling a story using that language and these elements, and it's very, very confident that when she says that line, you will simultaneously laugh because it's stupid and also go, yeah, that's thoroughly sincere.
Yes.
And I might cry.
I think there's a very strong queer element through this movie as well about that otherness and trying to exist in a culture that is not welcoming, and it is frightening. And you know, queer people do go to the big cities, you know, like it's so interesting that in a movie this queer, there isn't a queer character.
No, I thought I was expecting it to be more openly queer.
No, I know. It's really, it's like every character is, as far as I can see, heterosexual. Like there isn't
But it speaks to that. I think that's, again, by its specificity, it becomes universal. It's a good allegory for all sorts of othering.
Yes.
Othering on the basis of class, weight, looks, interests, intelligence, morality. She's othered in every single way.
Yeah.
So she works as a brilliant avatar for anyone who feels othered by a culture.
Yeah.
It's an incredibly inclusive film. And what a strange little spasm of Australian filmmaking that gave you all these sort of brightly coloured, life-affirming movies.
Yeah, but, you know, it is that response to just this kind of this toxic masculinity. And I think that there was just this sudden roar that kind of came out of very queer spaces that was pushing back against that. As we
sort of enter a world which is looking increasingly like it's going to start doing monoculture again.
Yeah.
And saying that, okay, you will be judged by this tick list of how much you conform, like the 1950s, to a certain set of standards. And if you're outside any of them, by the way, we'd rather you didn't tell us. Then films like this, I suppose, become more and more precious because they're going to... They're funny, but they're kind of screams.
Yes, yes. Oh, my God, yes. God, that is such a... Yeah, that's really good. It's a good piece of writing, Joel.
Thank you. Can I get my money back for the course?
No, it's non-refundable. Okay. I've already spent it.
It's a blank check.
Yeah, it's gone. That money's gone. It's so gone.
Okay, I think that's a good place to end. Do you got anything else you want to say?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
No.
Well, it's lovely. Thank you for introducing me to a film I hadn't seen before and a wonderful film.
Thank you so much. Thanks for taking the time and care and attention that you did with it. I think
that was so lovely.
Pays you back in spades, doesn't it?
Thanks for bringing me Muriel.
Yeah.
Comfort Blanket was presented and produced by Joel Morris for the Cheese and Pickle family of podcasts. Find us on social media and don't forget to like and subscribe.